Well, good morning and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. To my right is Justice Lee Gabriel, and to my left is Justice Mark Pittman. I'm Terry Livingston. Today, on the morning docket, we only have one case to be argued, and it's DeAngelis versus Protective Parents Coalition. I understand you all have checked in and got your time allocated. So we will begin with Mr. Ross.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, a brief summary of how we ended up here today. I represent Lori DeAngelis and Lori Robinson. We filed a 202 petition to do an investigative deposition for potential claims and potential defendants of the Protective Parents Coalition, a number of the directors for the Protective Parents Coalition, and a couple of other individuals who have published defamatory statements on the Facebook, social media, and the website of PPC. There are a number of issues before the court today. One of the first issues is whether or not a Rule 202 petition to do an investigative deposition qualifies for the Texas Citizen Participation Act dismissal relief. It's the appellant's contention that it does not. The purpose of TCPA is to encourage and safeguard the constitutional rights of persons to the right of petition, free speech, and association. As such, if a legal action is based on or relates to or is in response to a party's exercise of their First Amendment rights, they may file a motion to dismiss. The Texas Supreme Court has explained in In Re Depino that this procedure, the 202 investigative depositions, is purely an ancillary matter, that it is not an end within itself. Consequently, the purely procedural request would not result in legal or equitable relief. Appellants were seeking to investigate potential claims and or defendants, but following the procedure of TCPA, the appellees filed a motion to dismiss. If this court finds that TCPA or that the 202 depositions qualify under TCPA, the appellees would first have to show by a preponderance of evidence that the depositions were related to their First Amendment rights. And if the appellees were successful in showing by the preponderance of evidence that it related to their First Amendment rights, then the burden shifts back to the appellants. The appellants would then have to show by clear and specific evidence that there is a prima facie case for each and every element of defamation. Here, the appellants have no claims and have only sought to do investigative depositions. That would frustrate the purpose of the TCPA, to protect the rights of a person to file meritorious lawsuits. Appellees attempt to persuade this court with the case out of Austin at the end of last year, In Re Elliott. However, that Court of Appeals never addressed whether or not Rule 202 petitions to take depositions qualify for dismissal under TCPA. In fact, the conclusion of that case reads specifically as follows. I agree that mandamus should conditionally issue to restrain the district court's order, but I disagree with the court's analysis of the TCPA or that we should even address the statute here. See, what happened, Your Honors, in that case was that the district court judge granted the 202 petition after the Chapter 27 motion to dismiss was filed. And the Court of Appeals in Austin said, well, wait a minute. Once the motion to dismiss is filed, it stays all discovery. So what it did was reversed the district court's decision and sent the case back to be heard on the motion for dismissal. It didn't address, in this case, whether or not the 202 petition qualifies for dismissal.
But weren't you citing to the conclusion in the concurring opinion as opposed to the majority opinion in Elliott?
Well, the conclusion, you're correct, Your Honor. I was citing to the conclusion in the concurring opinion. However, the majority opinion still did not finally, what they've concurred was they discussed the collateral issues of whether Chapter 27 is applicable, but it wasn't part of their final decision. Appellees presented no evidence that they have a right, that their right to free speech was infringed upon. Free speech is defined as communication made in connection with a matter of public concern. Those things include stuff like health and safety, environmental issues, the government, a public official or public figuring, a good product or service in the marketplace. The Dallas Court of Appeals addressed this issue in Pickens v. Cordia. The appellee argued that the blog that was being done was a public concern because it dealt with issues such as addiction and child abuse and things such as that. But what the Court of Appeals in Dallas said was just because it addresses issues that may generally be of public concern, if they're addressed in a way that specifically deal with individuals and make false accusations, that it's more of a private complaint, not a public concern. And that's exactly what happened here. Appellees will try to argue that what they're doing is seeking change in the family district courts of Tarrant County, that there's a necessity to seek change. Now, that's a public issue. And that was admitted into the district court. But specifically what they did was they directly targeted certain lawyers, our clients, the appellants, and made false accusations about criminal acts, about their way of conducting business, and their ethical and moral behaviors. Those matters are not of public concern. Pickens relied on Miranda v. Boyles out of Houston. There, the appellant argued allegations of sexual abuse implicate a question of public importance. There, the court found that speaking of these two parties is a private issue. Sexual abuse, again, is a public concern, but specifically accusing individuals is a private issue. Just as in Miranda, the appellees here present no evidence anyone other than the appellants were likely to feel the impact of the resolution. Now, that's important because when you say certain things about a certain individual in a public forum, you are targeting that person. The average public, the average citizen, doesn't have any resolution, doesn't have any concern about that particular individual, and that's what happened here. Appellants are not public figures. There are two types of public figures, an all-purpose or general public figure or a limited purpose one. The rationale behind public figure doctrine is that he or she is risking or inviting the spotlight. General purpose public figure are rare creatures. Those are somebody like President Trump. When you mention his name, you immediately know who it is. Their notoriety is so significant that they can often cross across certain issues and still maintain their public status. Nor are the appellants limited purpose public figures because outside of the small family, Tarrant County family bar, they're not known. They don't get on the news, they don't have any recognition outside of Tarrant County family bar. There was no evidence presented at the district court that either of the appellants were public figures. Appellees claim that they are advocates for change in the family court system and that because family courts are a government entity, it's a public concern. There was no evidence that either of the appellants is a government entity. Both appellants are private lawyers. They have been appointed as ad litems in certain cases, but being appointed as an ad litem does not necessitate becoming a government entity. Appellees presented no evidence of their right to petition. The right to petition is a communication or pertaining to a judicial proceeding, official proceeding, executive proceeding, whether it's state or federal, a legislative proceeding, or other proceeding where public notice is given. There's a case, Herrera v. Stahl, in our brief, where Herrera claimed his statements were made pursuant to a judicial proceeding. However, the court found that the statements weren't made in a judicial proceeding. The statements were made after the judicial proceeding to the association he was a part of, reporting on the events of the judicial proceeding. That was found not to be a public proceeding. Specifically, Appellee Carlos did not even mention in her pleadings that there was any violation of her right to petition. Appellees presented no evidence of their right of association. A right of association must involve the public or citizens' participation and must pertain to the common interest. Just like Herrera, appellees here failed to provide any evidence or information of a specific common interest. In fact, Carlos only mentions that she didn't make any statements or provide any information that were derogatory or defamatory in nature. The arraigning appellees did not even mention in their pleadings their right of association at all. Should the court find that the 202 petitions qualify under TCPA and that we're going to do the analysis set out and the procedure set out in TCPA, that first burden was on the appellees to show that their rights were impacted, and they weren't. There was no evidence of that whatsoever. But should the court feel that their rights were affected, then the burden shifts to the appellants, where the appellants must show with clear and specific evidence that there is a prima facie case for each and every element of defamation. Since the appellants have no claims at all, there has been no claims brought, this is an impossible task. And another reason why a 202 petition would not apply. Nonetheless, appellants presented ample evidence, including 15 specific postings that were posted showing prima facie case for each and every potential element.
Let me ask this, counsel. Isn't there some way, though, that the two provisions, one of which is statutory, one of which is a rule, that they couldn't be harmonized or read together such that once somebody files a motion to dismiss, at that point then the petition for the 202 relief could be restricted, at least temporarily, under the anti-SLAPP statute? Because it talks about evidence.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. There is a provision where the court can restrict the discovery taking place pursuant to the 202, and that could have been done here, but it wasn't done, and we feel that it was an error not to do that. Alternatively,
did you present that option to the court?
We did, Your Honor, and it's in the record. Our position was, to the district court, and this was in the record, was had the court wanted to not allow the 202s, the proper mechanism would have been hearing the evidence on the motion to dismiss under Chapter 27, deny the motion to dismiss, but then don't also deny the 202 petition. And that would have been the proper mechanism. Alternatively, the trial court denied the motion to dismiss by operation of law. And here's what I'm talking about, Judge. The timeline for the motion to dismiss, when the trial court ultimately gave the judgment, it lost plenary power. Chapter 27 says, and I'm out of time, I'll leave with this. Chapter 27 says, may I proceed?
Yes, please.
Chapter 27 says, the trial court must rule within 30 days of the hearing. That did not happen. The hearing in this case was heard on February 11th. The trial court signs the final judgment on June 1st, well beyond the plenary power. The trial court hears attorney's fees on May 27th, well beyond the plenary power, and that was argued at that time in the trial court. The appellees had an opportunity to seek to modify the judgment and allow the attorney's fees and sanctions to be heard, but they did not do that.
So your request then is that the order relating to the attorney fees and costs is void. Is that what you're saying?
Not only the order relating to the attorney's fees and cost, but because the trial court erred and not ruling in a timely fashion, by a matter of law, the motion to dismiss must be denied.
Even though the trial court had signed an order granting the motion to dismiss within the 30-day period?
Even though the trial court signed that order, because the case was still opened and the trial court said, we're going to hear the attorney's fees at a later date. It was incumbent upon the appellees then to seek to modify that order to keep plenary power in the trial court, and they did not do that.
Okay, counsel. Mr. Ross, your time has expired. I'm sure we'll have follow-up questions.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Westfall.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Justices. Okay. Rule 202 has, you know, the Elliott Court discussed how it's an equitable remedy. Springs from equity, and the Elliott Court actually at page 504 Southwest 3rd 464 gives the history of Rule 202 and how it derived from equity. And the procedural posture there was a little bit different because it was up on mandamus because the trial court had refused to stay discovery. Justice Pemberton and his concurrence now had quibbled with that little thing. But what Justice Pemberton said would be the right way to do it is basically how we did it. And it's set out at page 482 of the same opinion, that the Rule 202 petitioner should, the trial court should address the claims. And the vehicle for doing that, I suppose, is the fact that it derives from equity, and you have to have clean hands. And if you're violating somebody's right to free speech, you don't have clean hands. And so it makes perfect sense why you would want to get to the claims, just like Justice Pemberton said. But if the Elliott Court was looking at this case, it would be a unanimous opinion, because I think we did exactly what Justice Pemberton would want. There is precedent, obviously, for Rule 202 not applying, and that's the Jordan case out of the Texas Supreme Court, I guess, 2008, 249 Southwest 3rd, 416, where it looks at it in the context of a medical negligence case. The statutory structure is there now where you have to get an affidavit, to show your case has merit before you can even go. And so, you know, they said the danger here is that you'll use a Rule 202 petition to try to circumvent that statutory requirement. So Rule 202 petitions just simply don't apply to medical negligence cases. So it's the issue with a rule conflicting with the statute, if I recall, the statute prevails. But in this case, I mean, there's getting to be a robust body of law surrounding the TCPA. It's interesting. But this here is just really very rudimentary statutory construction. And when you look at the words of the TCPA and how it defines legal action, this definition fits in there. And that was the upshot of the Elliott opinion, really. And Justice Pemberton didn't quibble about that.
Well, didn't he say you don't have to go that far? You don't even have to decide that issue. And that's how he would have handled it.
You know, perhaps so. But also, I think we have to consider the procedural posture of that case, how it was up on mandamus, and they had not addressed the issues. I think that Justice Pemberton, rather than let the Rule 202 circumvent the TCPA, because he was obviously concerned about that, I think would say that something like what we did here would satisfy his or her. Is Justice Pemberton a man or a woman? I'm sorry, I don't know. his or her concerns. But, you know, the opinion expresses the concerns about doing an end run around the TCPA using Rule 202. The concurring opinion discusses that.
Well, it seems like the purposes set forth in both of those provisions, just the objectives that the legislature was trying to reach, are diametrically opposed almost because of the limitation on discovery set forth in the TCPA.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly the legislative purposes of Rule 202 would be, I suppose, to try to get lawsuits, you know, investigated, and maybe they won't happen. But I think we can agree that in the right context, Rule 202 can be used as a bullying tactic just like a lawsuit can. And, in fact, that's what we have maintained the whole time in this case. And you look at their Rule 202 petition, it asks for things you can't even get under Rule 202. So, I mean, it clearly was an assault. And I think this case is a good example of how you can use 202, not just to investigate a claim, but to try to bully someone around. Does that make sense? And so, yeah, TCPA, you know, the statutory language is that it's supposed to be construed as broadly as possible to vindicate First Amendment rights, but then at the same time allowing meritorious lawsuits to go through. Anything else on the Rule 202 versus TCPA issue? I'd like to talk about one other little part of the statutory. There's a new case that just came out not long ago called ExxonMobil Pipeline Company versus Coleman. It's a brand new Texas Supreme Court opinion. It's found at 2017 Westlaw 727274, 60 Texas Supreme Court Journal 500. And then at star 3 in that, the court addresses the in connection with language, and which is what's required under statute, is that we are exercising speech in connection with one of the three rights vindicated by the First Amendment, in connection with, and then the lawsuit is an attempt to shut that down. And counsel has talked about Pickens all the way since the trial court, and I think we can finally do away with Pickens with this opinion. I mean, Pickens clearly was a blog about personal matters within a family by a disgruntled son. Dad, even though he's T. Boone Pickens, not a public figure, at least not for the purpose of what the son was doing, talking about his childhood and growing up on. This isn't a situation like that. And the trial court recognized that, that when we talk about the welfare of children, that's important public matter. But the TCPA does not require that the statements specifically mention health, safety, environment, or economic concerns, nor does it require more than a tangential relationship to the same. Rather, TCPA applicability requires only that the defendant's statements are in connection with issues related to health, safety, environmental, economic, and other identified matters of public concern chosen by the legislature. And that's the problem with Pickens, was that the statements were not made in connection with those public issues. The statements were made in connection with his bad relationship with his dad. You see, in this case, the trial court expressly found, really, that the statements were made in connection with. And I think that the case law on that matter, and I've cited a lot of it in my brief, clearly just backs us up on that. I think we were definitely in a situation where they had to prove up their prima facie case. The day before the hearing, they presented 15 statements that they believe were defamatory, and we addressed each one of them, fully litigated, with case law and argument in the trial court. There were no findings of fact, conclusions of law filed. There was a request made at one point, but there was no notice of past due findings, so they're not here, and they weren't properly requested at in the end. The court, when it comes to this prima facie case, all the evidence and decisions have to be construed to support the court's decision if it can be supported on any ground. And several of the published statements can be supported on several grounds that they failed to make their prima facie case. I roll through those certainly in my brief, but published statement one, the most court-appointed lawyers, number one, they didn't do anything to prove damages. There's an affidavit in there by one of the plaintiffs, and it basically just says we sustained damages, and so it's conclusory. Lipsky looked at some affidavits that were more detailed than what we have in this case, and they found those were conclusory. So on damages, we have, like I say in my brief, they put all their eggs in the defamation per se basket, and so that's kind of how it has to be looked at. To say that somebody is the most court-appointed lawyer is just simply, certainly not defamation per se. There's not going to be a case that shows that. Statements 2 through 6, here's the deal with the group libel doctrine, which I discuss in there. There are three pictures in that deal, that thing with the three most court-appointed lawyers. There's three pictures there. Only two of those people brought this action, so not even the whole group is represented. And so you never even know. In addition to just being group issues to begin with, where you say one of these people, which clearly under the law is not defamation, one of these people stole something, that fails from the group libel doctrine. But when not even all of them are involved in the lawsuit, how are we ever going to know if that one is someone that is not even involved in the lawsuit? And so their defamation claim is zero. They hadn't done anything to prove up damages or anything, So not even the whole group was represented in this case. So that's 2 through 6. Number 7, the worst court-appointed lawyers is an opinion. 8, 9, and 13 to 15 is Donna Tribunella. Now, Donna Tribunella was the person that was brought into this action late and then released with a non-suit, never properly served, never served. She made certain statements on the PPC public Facebook page, And then she made certain statements on her own social media that didn't have anything to do with PCC. And so those are all the rest of the statements from Statement 8 through Statement 15 are put together. Those are all Donna Tribunella statements. You can look at the way that the cases are decided, the prima facie cases are analyzed in all of these cases. And they go to an element-level analysis. And I believe the Supreme Court of Texas, but certainly in one of the recent cases, said that, yeah, we're a notice-pleading state, but this requires more than notice. This prima facie case requires more than notice. Okay? And so at the elemental level is how these need to be examined. And so when they don't even plead a theory for vicarious liability, those claims just fail. And they didn't plead or prove any theory of vicarious liability that would make us responsible for what Donna Tribunella does. I want to move to the attorney's fees real quickly. That was my counterclaim.
If you will, please, the jurisdictional question in regard to the authority to have the hearing continued at a later date to address attorney fees.
Okay. We requested attorney's fees and sanctions in our original motion. Attorney's fees and sanctions were not rendered in that original order, which was 30 days. And the statute only says rule. Statute doesn't say dismiss or judgment, and I cite in my brief a case that actually looks at that. And so she ruled from the bench and then issued orders the next day. She did everything she was supposed to do under the statute. The issue of attorney's fees and sanctions was left unresolved. It was discussed. And, 10 or 12 days later, I filed a motion asking for a hearing on the attorney's fees and sanctions. And in the meantime, Jason Smith had filed a motion for attorney's fees and sanctions. But the easiest, even without those things, the easiest way to look at it is we requested attorney's fees and sanctions in our original motion, and they were not decided yet, for or against. And so it was not a final judgment. And if it's not a final judgment, then it's not a final judgment for appellate purposes, and none of these deadlines he's talking about start to run.
Well, wouldn't the final judgment beyond 30 days be void?
No, Your Honor, because the statute requires 30 days to rule. She ruled.
Not on the attorney's fees and sanctions?
Not on the attorney's fees and sanctions. But but she did rule on the dismissal, which I think is what the statute requires. And
does it matter that the judgment doesn't indicate that it's final and appealable?
It didn't indicate that. I mean,
that's what I'm asking. Does that matter in this case?
Well, sure, it matters.
Tell me why that matters.
Because, when you analyze something to see whether it is a final judgment, words in the judgment matter for that analysis. Like, does it have a Mother Hubbard clause? Does it say that it's actually a final and appealable judgment? Does it, under the rules, give all of the relief that was that was asked for? And this order didn't have any of those. So it had none of the telltale signs of a final judgment. Did I answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. It had none of those telltale signs. We asked the court to affirm the appeal, but on our appeal, we asked the court just to render a judgment because the attorney's fees were already determined to have been reasonable, and then they were cut, like I say in my brief, after that determination was made.
So your position is that the half that was cut out should be restored?
Yes, Your Honor. For the reasons basically in the Abramson or Abraham case.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Ross, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. If the court reads the record on the day of the hearing on the motion to dismiss, you'll find the district court specifically stated in the record that this will become final when no other parties are in this case, period. The appellee's counsel both provided proposed orders dismissing the action on the day of the hearing or the immediate day after. The day after the hearing is when the trial court signed the dismissal order. On February 22nd, the trial court signed the non-suits that appellants had filed on February 17th, thereby eliminating all remaining defendants in the case. At that point, the case was done. Final. What had happened was after that, several months after that, the appellees filed their motion for attorney's fees and sanctions. And our position is simple. It was incumbent upon appellee's counsel to preserve the plenary power of the court by simply filing a motion to modify the judgment, to modify the dismissal order, and to keep that plenary power open until the attorney's fees and sanctions were heard. They didn't do that. When they did not do that, Chapter 27 is clear. You have to have an order on everything. You can't piecemeal it because attorney fees and sanctions are mandatory under the chapter. So you can't subsequently say, well, it wasn't quite final yet, because the Chapter 27 says you must rule within 30 days, and ruling by definition means completely addressing everything in Chapter 27. That simply was not done. The Pickens case is still good law. There's no distinguishing between Pickens and what's going on here just because it was T-Bone Pickens' son saying bad things about him. That's not the analysis that was used. He was saying bad things about dad being a drunk and abusive to the children. Those are things of public concern, just like the PPC trying to say, well, we're saying bad things about these lawyers because that's what causes all of these problems in Tarrant County family courts. When you say specific things that impugns one's ability to make a living, that challenges their ethics and morals, that is defamation per se. When you accuse somebody of committing crimes, that is defamation per se. And you don't have to prove damages in those situations.
Just for purposes of argument, how do you address the Sullivan versus Abraham case?
Sullivan versus Abraham case is the brand new case, Your Honor, and I'm going to be honest with you. When you read that case, there was a huge, lengthy debate about where the comma was placed in Chapter 27 and whether or not Chapter 27 allows a district court to use the to render attorney's fees and sanctions as justice and equity provides, as is typically done. Counsel's right. I'm not going to deny the fact that the Abrams case has come out and said that under Chapter 27, that analysis is done differently now. So there's no rebuttal on that because that's what the court has said on that.
So do you agree that if we were, to go that way, that the proper ruling would be to restore the half that was cut?
Judge, Your Honor, I would love to be able to stand here and say that's absolutely not the case. I disagree with the Abrams case, but that's what they say. I've disagreed in a bunch of cases before. And the trial court did say, and here's the only caveat I would throw out there with that, the trial court did say that she found the attorney's fees reasonable, but she cut them. However, she equalized the two appellees' attorneys' fees. Mr. Smith was billing at $400 an hour. Mr. Westfall was billing at $250 an hour. When she awarded the fees, although she cut them, she allowed him to bill at $400 an hour when the testimony didn't reflect that that's his billable rate. How that was done, I don't know. So I agree that Abram says once the attorney's fees are reasonable, you have to go along with that. But the testimony didn't reflect the attorney's fees that were awarded at $400 an hour. They reflected attorney's fees at $250 an hour.
Wrap up your statement.
Yes, Your Honor. The last thing I wanted to say was regarding Ms. Donna Tribunello, who was ultimately non-suited. Case law is abundantly clear that when you allow people to post on your media, you become liable for it. And Ms. Tribunella was posting some of the most horrific comments about the appellants that anybody could have. And PPC allowed it to happen. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, counsel. Mr. Westfall, Mr. Ross, we appreciate all your arguments today and all the research and briefing both of you undertook in this matter, as it is sort of a new issue or a new twist on a recent issue. Your case is submitted, and you all are excused, and we will adjourn.